I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. Today's fluctuating interest rates can leave you with unexpected higher mortgage payments. At Quicken Loans, we've created a new way to protect you from unpredictable interest rates so you can buy a home with certainty. It's called Rate Shield, and here's how it works. With Rate Shield, you can lock your interest rate while you shop for a new home. So if rates go up, you don't have to worry. And here's the best part. If rates go down, you get the lower rate. With Rate Shield, we really have you covered. Here are more reasons why you'll want to work with America's largest mortgage lender. For 9 years in a row now, J.D. Power has ranked Quicken Loans highest in the nation in customer satisfaction for primary mortgage origination. And for the fifth year in a row, they've also ranked us highest in the nation for mortgage servicing. Rate Shield. Another way we can save you money on your mortgage. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Based on Rocket Mortgage data in comparison to public data records. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. My name is Dan Favalli, coming at you, as always, with my super-duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times awesome, fantabulous, spectaculario, the big analytic who wants Jim Boylan to get a five-year extension from the Chicago Bulls, co-host Andrew D. Bailey. Before we get started with the second half of our midseason report card grades for the NBA, I just want to remind, implore, beg, plead with everyone to continue rating, reviewing, and subscribing to us on iTunes. We really appreciate it when we see those numbers go up. Throw us that five-star review. It takes 15 seconds out of your day to search Hardwood Knox on iTunes. Leave some feedback in the comments section. You can always get at us on Twitter if you want as well. We can also be found wherever else your podcasts are gotten to, but iTunes is the best way to let us know that you're out there and that you're listening. If you have not subscribed yet, please do that. If you have not seized your friends, families, frenemies, rando people on the streets, phones, and subscribed them to us as well, we highly recommend that as long as you can do it in a safe fashion. That was meant mainly for any randos you might meet on the street. But without further delay, we ask the question that everyone is always dying to know the answer to. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm very excited to talk about the Eastern Conference today.
Well, that's, I don't think anyone's ever said that before.
Yeah, as soon as it came out of my mouth, I thought that was like the least convincing thing I've ever said.
Yeah, that was really like, I don't support lying to our listeners, so.
Try that again. I'm very excited to talk about the Eastern Conference today.
That was a better lie, but everyone still knows it's a lie. I guess we should just get right into it. I believe you are on Atlanta Hawks key stat duty this time.
I am. And I decided to throw you a curveball today. I'm not going to talk about Trae Young's three-point percentage.
I mean,
so here's where I'm at. I feel like, and I actually tweeted this maybe like 2 or 3 weeks ago, I feel like we don't talk about John Collins enough as like the general NBA fan sphere. He is ridiculously productive, especially for the amount of minutes that he plays. He averages a triple-double in last I checked, not triple-double. He averages a double-double. Last I checked in under 30 minutes. Right now he's at exactly 30 minutes, averaging 18.8 points and 10.4 rebounds. Shooting almost 60% from the field. That's actually down a little bit over the last few weeks. But I did just sort of your typical player search. And I did it for his per possession numbers. So he actually averages 21.7 points, 11.9 rebounds, and 2.8 assists per 75 team possessions. There have been 56 seasons in NBA history where all three of those marks were met. And if you sort it by true shooting percentage, he is fourth. The only people ahead of him are 2019 Domantas Sabonis, 2017 Nikola Jokic, and 2019 Giannis Antetokounmpo. Then if you limit the search again to players who are just in their first or second seasons, there's only 8 total seasons, and the only person ahead of him is that same 2017 Jokic season. Collins is legit, and I think the Hawks in general they're pretty exciting over the last few weeks. I'm coming around on Trae Young. I think he's been a little bit better over the last month or two. Kevin Herter has showed some things. They have a trio right there in those three guys, and I actually looked up their net rating when those three are on the floor maybe a week or so ago, and it was pretty good. So there is definite reason for optimism and encouragement with this young core, and I'm just realizing now that I never said they're great. I gave them a C+. I could probably even be talked into going a little higher than that because I don't know how we could have expected much more than what they're giving us right now, but they are still 14-32, so I'm docking them a little bit, but I like I said, I think I could probably be talked into like the B- range.
Yeah, I'm with you there. When I was doing midseason report card grades for Bleacher Report, I gave them, I think, a C or a C+, and I just gave them a B- now, and I gave them a C here the first time around. That's confusing for everyone. I have them at a B- right now. So everything you just said, I'm with you there. I think we've also seen more out of DeAndre Bembry as well. As you said, Kevin Herter. Trae Young, you were going to talk about his three-point percentage. Here's a flattering Trae Young three-point percentage stat. Since December 8th, he is shooting 36.9% from deep on nearly 5 attempts per game. And so we're talking about more than a 20-game sample size there. And I picked that date because I believe that's the day that they got – they've been getting, like, really good just wins, like whether it was over the Thunder or they're just stealing these random games on the road. And that seems to have coincided with John Collins's return as well. And so he's added kind of this – nice pep to their step, so to speak. And so, like I picked that day because that's when they beat the Nuggets. Like, they've just picked up some nice wins over the past month and a half or so. And the thing I'm still disarmed by when I watch them is seeing John Collins make more decisions with the ball in his hands. Like, whether it's driving or taking a jumper, like an unassisted jumper, he's not shooting an incredibly high percentage on those looks, but they're really trying to expand his offensive workload, and that's probably the key to him really being able to survive against other postmodern fours, since he's undersized for the five. The defensive lineups with him there, when they do, in those scant possessions that they do play him at center, have not been great. I still wonder where his best position is going to be long term, but just the way he's coming along offensively right now, it does seem like he'll be able to be a full-time power forward without much issue. And I think you need to give them credit for just their development overall of some of these guys. Again, I think Bembry, I haven't left that train yet. A lot of people are out on Torian Prince. I'm not there yet. So I thought they would have been a little bit better defensively this season. But again, the team is bad, but they're designed to be bad, and there are more than a few bright spots to look at.
Yeah, and just to confirm what I said earlier, they are plus 0.9 points per 100 possessions, which is the 56th percentile, when Trae Young, Kevin Herter, and John Collins are all on the floor. And they're in the 79th percentile for offense when those three are there. So I think if you had to pick three guys to be your young core, I think that would probably be it. And for them to already be positive in year one together is really encouraging.
Yeah, for sure. So that brings us to the Boston Celtics. They are, this is all per Cleaning Glass, 10th in offensive efficiency, 5th in defensive efficiency, 3rd in net rating, and 29-18. We both gave them B- the first time around, and we are giving them B- again. The Celtics are, I want to say fine would be the best word to sort of really describe them. The kind of offensive struggles that everyone was worried about in the aggregate have really been overblown. It was for basically a few weeks in the season. They are, my key stat for them is they are 5th in offensive efficiency per Cleaning the Glass since the end of November. And so we're talking about a 26-game sample size for them, which equates to most of the season. What's really been disappointing is not Kyrie Irving. I'll tell you that. I've been one of the more reluctant ones to place him in the top 10 player conversations. I think he's there this year. Might be he gets there by the skin of his teeth at number 10 or something. He's been absolutely spectacular. Better playmaker since he came to Boston. Trying harder on defense. We could say he's gotten better on defense, I guess, but it looks like he just tries harder with the way that he handles screens and things like that. And he is just their lifeblood on the offensive end. That a guy like Jason Tatum, who's only a sophomore, but he's the closest thing, I guess, you have to a second offensive lifeline, and Boston's offense craters whenever Kyrie Irving is off the floor. And yet they've just been disappointing to the extent that they're supposed to be drowning in this depth, and they kind of are, but it's also not really working in an overwhelming fashion. Maybe Gordon Hayward, we always should have assumed that he would need the entire year to sort of get by, but Jaylen Brown's been up and down. He's played, I guess, more consistent in recent weeks, but not exactly spectacular. Terry Rozier has just absolutely cratered whatever trade value he had, and the goodwill he built up during that playoff stretches last season is kind of gone for the most part. His free agency is all of a sudden going to be interesting. Boston is still, their bench is still seventh in point differential per 100 possessions. They don't scare or intimidate the way that I thought they would. And again, they've gotten up for some really big games. Kyrie Irving's playing really well. Jason Tatum's performance has evened out. Al Horford is kind of starting to come around, but even he's been a roller coaster. It seems like while this team has dealt with some injuries, that they're more seesaw-y than I would have predicted when I don't think either of us had them at first place in the East coming into the season. Neither of us, but both of us definitely did not have them outside the top four.
No, I didn't. I didn't expect them to struggle this much. When I looked them up last night, though, I was a little surprised by this. Can you guess where they rank in the NBA by SRS, which is just point differential plus strength of schedule?
Oof. That's a good question. Is eight too high?
They are fourth.
Oh, wow.
In the NBA and SRS, which surprised me. That was kind of the same reaction that I had. I was ready to give them maybe half a grade worse. But I think they've quietly just been sort of solid and steady, especially since they made that move to put Marcus Smart in the starting lineup. It seems like that stabilized things a little bit. I also ran
Marcus Smart, by the way, quietly shooting better than 36% from three.
Yeah.
On pace to have a better true shooting percentage than Kemba Walker.
that second part I did not know. That's crazy. I don't know if it was this summer or at the start of the season, I just asked on Twitter, like, where would Marcus Smart rank among NBA guards if he just shot average? And somebody dug that tweet up like a week or two ago and said, see? And yeah, he's been really good. If you do that thing I do where you sort players by their average ranks, he's been comfortably top 50 all season long. So I don't think Boston has lived up to the hype that it had coming into this season. I don't think many people would argue with that. That clip making the rounds a week or so ago of the video was like the Celtics fighting on the bench, and the audio overlaid over the top of it was Bill Simmons on his podcast in the preseason talking about how they were going to win 60 games and there was going to be a ton of games where they're all high-fiving each other on the bench through the fourth quarter. It has not been super smooth sailing for Boston, but I think they've kind of weathered the storm. And like you said, Kyrie Irving has been ridiculous this season. If he's not top 10, he's certainly top 15 and like knocking on the door of top 10 this season. So when you have that number one guy who's a legit top 10 player, everything else can kind of fall into place, I guess, unless you're the New Orleans Pelicans. It's just been sort of a not quite what we expected, but still a solid season to this point for the Celtics. So that's what I gave them a B minus as well. I know Dan already said that, but
and we might even be they're 11 games over 500. We're talking about their struggles, which is I think just speaks to the expectations that they have. But they've been, I mean, they have the third best net rating in the league in victories. I could probably talk myself into a B, but they have not. You know, when you're in that B minus C plus B range, that's basically meeting expectations, and I don't think that they've necessarily met expectations when looking at the big picture. And forget about, you know, they're right there in the East, but the Terry Rozier stuff specifically, the Gordon Hayward and his recovery from injury, Jaylen Brown and kind of just begging for more consistency from him, which again, they've gotten for just large segments. He's probably the least of their concerns at this point. I am interested to see how the rotation kind of finishes the season. I don't think we're going to see all these guys coming off the bench all year, but there are just so many more questions than I thought that we would have. And again, maybe that's on us. Like, maybe this just should have been assumed because Gordon Hayward was coming his way back from a huge injury. They were integrating another star into the fold, and that this was all going to be sort of a jumbled mess for a while.
You think they'll put Hayward and Brown back in the starting lineup at some point?
One of them, right? I don't know. Like, I don't know when, but it just, I can't. I would be surprised if we go into the postseason and both Jaylen Brown and Gordon Hayward are still coming off the bench.
I guess I wouldn't be shocked. I just feel like they've been – maybe Hayward gets his legs back underneath him at some point. I was looking at his game log as we've been talking. He's had basically two good games this entire season, and they were both against the Minnesota Timberwolves, which was kind of funny. If you take out – Gordon Hayward versus everyone in the league but the Timberwolves, he's averaging 9.8 points, shooting 39.9% from the field and 29.5% from three.
He has not been one of the top 100 players in the league this year, which is a miss.
Yeah, it's and like you said, maybe we should have just thought he needs the entire season all along, but I thought he would be even maybe a slowed down version of himself. I thought he'd be a little bit more effective than this. I do think it's helped him to come off the bench a little bit, but maybe you're right. Maybe eventually
it covers up some of like the efficiency problems because he's going up against different sorts of lineups.
And he's kind of the main playmaker for a lot of those bench units, which is something that I think he's still been solid at this season. But, I guess just like the team, it just hasn't been as smooth sailing as we thought it would be.
Yeah, the him and the Terry Rozier stuff. Again, Jaylen Brown has leveled off for the most part, still a little bit more swinging than I think you'd want. And then again, I guess they've beaten out expectations in the sense that Marcus Morris is just on fire this year. And
he's helped a
lot. Yeah, and Marcus Smart, again, his three-point shooting coupled with his defense.
I'm adding that note about Marcus Smart's
that should probably just be the key stat. I don't know why I highlighted Boston's offensive efficiency since when everyone thought that they were probably a little bit worse on offense. But that does bring us to the Brooklyn Nets. They are 13th in offensive efficiency, 20th in defensive efficiency, 18th in net rating, and 25-23 overall. 2 games over 500 in 6th place in the East. We both gave them B-minuses last time. I'm going to spoil your grade again and say that we both gave them A-minuses this time. I'm not even sure really where the A-minuses are coming from. They still have some defensive things to work out, but they've even competed on that end of the floor on certain nights, and they are dealing with a ton of injuries. Jared Dudley's banged up. Alan Crabb's banged up. Caris LeVert is still out. I don't know how much any of those guys really help their defense. I think LeVert definitely could. Still, this is just the job being done in Brooklyn right now is absolutely phenomenal. I have 2 key stats for them to kind of show how they've turned a corner. They're one of the knocks against, not against them, but one of the questions about them was, can Spencer Dinwiddie and D'Angelo Russell play together? And while Kenny Atkinson still seems to like only closing the games with one of them, since December 1st, when these two shared the floor, the Nets are a plus 4.6 points per 100 possessions. Not only that, their defensive rating during those minutes is a 96.3.
Wow.
So that took me back a little bit. And then the knock against this team was that they could not win close games at the beginning of the season. And that's where you saw like there weren't many of them, but there were the hot take Twitter artists that were since last season really have said that Kenny Atkinson needs to be fired. And I always laughed when I saw that. Before December 1st, they were 4-10 in crunch time situations with a minus 23.9 net rating. Since December 1st, They are 10-4 in crunch time with a plus 6.8 net rating. So they are winning close games now. They're just so deep when you look at their talent. I mean, we're talking about a team that gets Travion Graham back and then all of a sudden starts playing him key minutes, whether it be in crunch time or putting him with the starting lineup. But Rodion Kurucs has been a revelation for them. Spencer Dinwiddie is still good. Jared Allen is an absolute monster. It's just looking at this team from top to bottom, everyone is just, they come at you every single night. I think that's been a compliment they've routinely gotten under Kenny Atkinson. Joe Harris as well, still just shooting the lights out, and he can do more stuff with the ball in his hands than people really give him credit for. That they're now just in the playoff races, it's like, it's not astounding, because when you watch them play, it just makes sense. But this rebuild, their picks were just gone, their own picks, for basically forever. And yet now they're back into the playoffs during year three of Kenny Atkinson. So it's just, this team is, I don't really know what you do to really nitpick against them at this point.
Yeah, I don't really know either. like you said, maybe we're even being a little bit too tough of graders by putting that minus on there. They're up to sixth in the Eastern Conference, which is just crazy. They've been really, really solid this season. I don't know how much I have to add to that. I love the Russell and Dinwiddie potential, but it's been, the net rating has been conference negative for two seasons, and I didn't realize that if you filtered it since December 1st, it was solid. So that's really encouraging that they're starting to figure out how to play together, because I think that's kind of the future of the NBA, is multiple guys who kind of have shooting guard size, but still have all the point guard skills. It kind of helps Brooklyn play some positionless basketball. At some point, they may get Caris LeVert back this season too, which is really enticing. Those three and Joe Harris on the floor together could be really, really interesting, with Jared Allen obviously protecting the rim. They've just got a lot of really encouraging signs here. And I know everybody's been patting Sean Marks on the back for two or three years, however long he's been there, but I think he deserves it to turn the team around as quickly and efficiently and cleverly as Sean Marks has. I think he deserves all the credit in the world. And boy, that D'Angelo Russell for Brook Lopez trade just looks worse and worse for the Lakers.
Especially because they didn't bring Brook Lopez back this season, who would have been perfect for them.
Your rental. And Russell now, he's up to 55th in the NBA in that average rankings thing that I do. So he's if he hasn't completely turned the corner yet, the corner is within sight for him. He's been really good here the last few weeks.
Yeah, I'm totally with you there.
That brings us to the Hornets.
Is he their best prospect now to you?
I guess he's kind of been their best prospect to me the whole time. I know I've been like on and off the bandwagon.
I've been, someone's tagging me on Twitter every 5 seconds whenever D'Angelo Russell does something well, and I've caught shit from other people too.
I've seen those.
Yeah, he's exceeding my expectations. I was wrong to be out on him. It's still okay to me to like any one of Dinwiddie, Allen, or even Caris LeVert a little bit better.
And I don't think Kurucs, I didn't know you were going to finish the sentence that way. Kurucs is really exciting too. I don't think I'd put him ahead of any of those guys.
Yeah, now you're going to start a war if you put Kurucs in front of him.
Yeah. But I think if I had to pick one, it would probably be Russell. The other factor in this is Dinwiddie's 25, LeVert's 24, and Russell is only 22.
That's certainly fair to point out. I was wrong about D'Angelo Russell. I don't know if I'm ready to call him their best long-term prospect. I'm also just really high on Jared Allen. But again, D'Angelo Russell is the one generating all-star buzz at this point. So
wouldn't that be him. It'd be wild if he got into the All-Star game.
Anything's possible in the East.
Yeah,
probably
really,
not that though, but anything's possible.
That takes us to the Charlotte Hornets. They're 11th in offense, 19th in defense, 15th in net rating. They're 22-24. I gave them a B minus at the quarter poll. You gave them a B. I gave them a C this time. We're like right.
We've only stepped so far.
Yeah. We were just barely off on the Hawks. I went C plus, B minus. We both have C's here for the Hornets. So same grade on three of the four teams. Anyway, I had the key stat for the Hornets. On November 17th and 19th, Kemba Walker scored 103 points in two games. At that point in the season, he was averaging 29.6 points on a true shooting percentage just over 60, 6.1 assists and 4.1 threes. And Charlotte was 8-8. Since then, he's averaging 22.6 points on 531 true shooting, so about 7.5% worse. 5.4 assists and 2.8 threes, and Charlotte's 14-16. And the reason I highlighted the records, 8-8 and 14-16 aren't that much different. But I just, as I was looking that up, I thought Kemba Walker basically has to be Superman for this team to just play 500 basketball. And then maybe it's encouraging that they haven't fallen off too much as he's fallen off, but it's not encouraging that he's got to average close to 30 points on 60 plus true shooting for them to just play 500. I mean, I still think there's a chance they get into the playoffs in the Eastern Conference. I don't even know what position they're in right now. They are currently, why can't I find
they're in eighth. 22-24 is eighth.
So they are in the playoffs right now. Maybe they hold on to that spot. Maybe they don't. But I think we've talked about this a bunch of times. They're just sort of butting their heads against the ceiling that this team has for two or three years now. They're not going to get another level out of Nick Batum or Marvin Williams. Malik Monk is only in his second year, so it's probably not fair to cap his ceiling yet, but he doesn't look a whole lot different than he did as a rookie. It just sort of feels like they've taken this group as far as they can, and it's not terribly far, but it's I know you've talked more than just about anybody about the kind of potential trades that the Hornets could make. They're probably not at that point yet. I'm sure we would have gotten some kind of report if they were. They'd probably dump the Batum contract as soon as they could if somebody was willing to take that. But anyway, this is just sort of my long-winded way of saying they've sort of hit their cap, I think, and I don't know what they do from here if they keep this same roster.
Yeah, if they're not going to trade Kemba Walker and there's been no indication that they will, there's not much they can do. Maybe you could pursue a Kevin Love trade, but without seeing him play post-toe injury, you don't really know what you get from him. They would have to probably exhaust every single asset they have to get in the conversation for Bradley Beal, if he's even available. Mike Conley would be super interesting alongside Kemba Walker, since the Grizzlies, per Woj, are, I don't know if they're ready to blow it up, but they're entertaining offers for both Gasol and Conley. I don't know that you have, without including Nicholas Batum's contract, I don't know that you really have the assets to make that work. You could build something around Marvin Williams and MKG, I guess, but I don't know how much that elevates your ceiling and the injury risk there with Conley. Then again, you're not going to have cap space for a couple summers if you keep Kemba Walker and you're not a free agency destination anyway. And I know Hornets fans kind of tire of hearing about the whole Kemba Walker versus like carrying this team on his own line. It's just so true. And there was a point at the beginning of this year where the Hornets were starting to survive on offense without him, and it's not happening anymore. And they, one of the biggest problems with this roster is that the person they are paying to be their second best player has been their sixth or seventh best player or fifth best player or something like that. Batum has the lowest usage rate on the Hornets. Bismack Biyombo has a higher usage rate than Nicholas Batum. You can't play max money for someone to finish such a small percentage of plays and to just be just this low volume, sometimes non-existent factor. And that's really where they've missed, is they've yet to put a viable number two around him. Right now, their second best player is probably Jeremy Lamb or a healthy Cody Zeller, and that's just not going to cut it. I don't know what types of trades they can pursue to really improve the team then. It's they're like in an all or nothing type of scenario. They can't really make that minor swing that could make them you know, maybe 4 or 5 wins better this season and be comfortably in the playoffs, they either have to just consolidate all their assets and take a risk on a bigger name who's not necessarily a sure thing, or they have to hold serve and hope that things somehow resolve themselves over the off season. And so I'm right there with you. Like you, as you said, I gave them a C as well.
And that takes us to the Chicago Bulls.
Just something to highlight Kemba Walker's workload. James Harden is the only player in the NBA who is averaging more pull-up attempts per game. And Kemba Walker ranks 8th overall in the NBA in contested shot attempts per game. That's the type of workload that he's dealing with in Charlotte.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that. It's very high. All right, the Bulls. This one's kind of funny. I didn't really know where to go with the Bulls.
Do you have their vitals?
Oh, yes. That's a good place to start. Thank you. 30th in offense. 30th in offense, 24th in defense, 29th in net. They're 11-36. We each gave them a D at the quarter poll. I gave them a D plus now. I'm not, like, as I look at it, I don't even know why I gave them a plus. Before we started recording, I told you that I was going to try to needle Jim Boylan, but they're pretty much exactly the same in terms of offense, defense, and net before and after the Fred Hoiberg firing. So shout out to him for maintaining where they were. Instead, I looked at Jabari Parker. The Bulls are minus 9.3 points per 100 possessions when he's on the floor, which is the 15th percentile. And they're minus 12.1 points per 100 possessions, which is the 8th percentile when he's off. What I would consider their three big acquisitions over the last 2 years, Jabari Parker, Lauri Markkanen, and Zach LaVine, those three guys have only shared the floor for 51 possessions the entire season. And Chicago's minus 0.3 points per 100 possessions, which is the 49th percentile in those situations. Obviously, that's a minuscule sample size. That's like half of one NBA game. And I kind of get why they haven't shared the floor a whole lot. One thing I think they've done right is play a lot of minutes to Wendell Carter Jr. He's clearly the center of the future, and so it's hard to get Carter, Parker, and Markkanen all on the floor at the same time. But you would think at some point they would have at least tried to play those three guys that they've spent assets and literal cap space on over the last 2 seasons. Try to get those three guys on the floor together just to see what you've got. I know they kind of sent Parker home for a while and suddenly he's playing again. I'm not really sure. I don't know what's going on there. It's hard to imagine them bringing him back next season. I know the second year is not guaranteed, but just a little bit more creativity with lineups, maybe playing those three guys together. I really don't know how to analyze the Bulls at this point. I mean, they just kind of are what they are. I don't think anybody could have expected them to be very good this season. And so here we are. I just, like I said, they've kind of maxed out the roster with Charlotte. I feel like they've maxed out the front office with Chicago. I don't know.
Yeah. About how, 5 years ago.
Yeah. I don't know how you expect to take another step, in a meaningful, positive direction if you just keep the same guys making all the decisions. It's hard to see where they go from here.
I wonder what the logic was for them to just put Jabari Parker back in the rotation.
There was never an explanation for it. There was an explanation for him being sent home and not playing anymore, and then all of a sudden he was just playing again. it's interesting. Maybe they're trying to showcase him.
Well, it's not working.
Put him in a trade. I wonder, as you talk, I'm going to look up like what he's done since he came back.
Well, so I gave – so I, as I said at the Western Conference podcast, I'm only going to give out 1 A+, which I gave the Denver Nuggets, and I'm going to give out 1 F, which I was on the fence about whether I was going to give to the Bulls or just not use it all. I'm still giving it to the Bulls. If you're going to be bad, at least be bad somewhat quietly. And just with all the stuff going on with Boylan. They haven't done that. The Parker stuff, they really haven't done that. They've been a little bit better defensively, or they've been better defensively since he's taken over, but their offense, you talk about creativity, it's just some of the least inventive stuff I've ever seen. I guess they don't have the personnel to do anything, but they're 30th in offensive efficiency since he took over. They are in effective field goal percentage. They are 28th during that time. They aren't a team that gets to the foul line. They're 30th in free throw rate since he took over. They're not a team that protects the ball. They're 28th in turnover percentage since he took over. Their offensive rebounding percentage is right around the bottom, too, since he took over. It's 26. They're up to 26. They were at 28th the last time I looked. So congratulations to the Bulls. And their shot profile is just not good. Zach LaVine is getting to the rim more than ever, but the Bulls are 28th in three-point attempts per 100 possessions with Boylan at the head. It's just they have some bright spots. Lauri Markkanen, Wendell Carter Jr. injured now, and he was going through kind of a slump, but he's still really fun to watch. And it looks like they might have a blueprint to a not hopeless rebuild when you consider him again, Markkanen, and even Zach LaVine. I know his efficiency has been all over the place this year, but his role is not easy. He's taking a ton of difficult looks. That he's shooting 49.1% from 2-point range when many of his jumpers and shots are just unassisted is actually impressive to me. There are bright spots there, but look, whenever you almost have a mutiny during the first week of a new head coach on the job, there's an issue, and they've just been unable to be quietly bad, which I think is an issue. And the whole stuff with Jabari Parker, that I support them not moving Robin Lopez or buying him out now, rather, until they exhaust every option at the trade deadline. The Jabari Parker stuff, you need to just get over, like, somehow. And I'm also maybe preemptively penalizing them for not showing a willingness to take on bad salary in exchange for picks and prospects. There was that report from, I believe it was Woj, that those have been non-starters for the Bulls when they're talking about Jabari Parker and Robin Lopez trades. They don't want to take on money, and I think that's the wrong mindset for them to have.
Yeah, when you're at this point in a rebuild, you got to be willing to at least explore that. Here's some fun numbers for you. So Parker's been back for 5 games. He's averaging 16.7 minutes, 13 points, 4.2 rebounds, shooting 58% from the field, 54% from three, and he's a plus 0.2. Per 36.
So showcasing him is working, is what you're saying.
Per 36 minutes in those 5 games, he's averaging 28 points, 9 rebounds, 4.3 assists. Obviously, the shooting percentages don't change. I'm out on Jabari Parker as a Chicago Bull. I'm not totally out on him in the right situation somewhere else.
Are you gonna start banging the Jabari to Utah drum again?
No, I'm kind of out on that. Fine. Although I still think there are so many players that I think just haven't been in the right situation and haven't been coached quite right. Like, he had Jason Kidd for his entire time in Milwaukee, and now he's in this dumpster fire of a situation in Chicago. So I think it would be really interesting if he was somewhere where he was exclusively a four, maybe even some like small lineup five, with a team that, if not encouraged, taught him to play some defense. I still think there's a roadmap to some level of success for him. I have a question that just popped into my head. If you had to pick one or the other, would you take him or Wiggins?
Are contracts a thing? If we're factoring in contracts, I'm taking Jabari Parker, hands down.
Yeah, say let's throw out contracts.
That's tough.
I think I'm probably still Parker. I think he's shown chops as a playmaker. I think he's clearly
rebounding. He's been an efficient scorer at times when you look at kind of what he's done with the Bucks. So, yeah, I mean, I'll give you that.
Just an interesting thought experiment. All right, I think we're done with the Bulls.
That brings us to the Cavs, another team that it's really just hard to, I don't know, look at. They're 24th in offensive efficiency, 30th in defensive efficiency, and 30th in net rating, a record of 9-39. You gave them an incomplete the first time overall, and I'm laughing now, and people know why soon. I gave them a C-. I don't tend to give out incompletes. I gave them a C. I just, they're playing the right players. I don't know that you can look at them and say that their guys have developed. They don't have a ton of guys to develop, but this team is barren, and they've already, they are one of the only teams that have shown a willingness to take on salary beyond this season. They're letting Colin Sexton kind of get his run. The key stat I have for them is more curious than not, and I'm giving them a C, or you could throw them in the C minus area as well, just because I don't think you look at this roster and can expect them to be any better than they are. If you want to dock them for the fact that they should, that the front office should have realized they were going to be in a rebuild post LeBron sooner than they did, then yes, absolutely, give them a lower grade. This surprised me when I looked this up. Cleveland is 10th in 16th in turnover percentage this year, and I would have just expected them to be worse. You have, when you remove Kevin Love from the equation and his 4-game sample size, Jordan Clarkson and Colin Sexton are your players with the 2 highest usage rates. You've been relying on Alec Burks. Cameron Payne has sprinkled his way into the rotation when he was there. I would have thought they would have coughed the ball up at a higher rate, and it's like that they haven't is almost impressive to me. I know that that's kind of, I just didn't want to focus on the negative. Colin Sexton shooting better from 3 than I thought. The fact, however, though, that he is shooting 38.9% from 3 while having a true shooting percentage below 50 is actually really impressive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of anyone, I actually looked this up too, and this, I didn't want to make it a key stat because it was too, it was too like in a wheelhouse, but of everyone in NBA history who's attempted at least 100 threes and shot 38.8% or better on them, Colin Sexton, 2018-2019, Colin Sexton has the 5th lowest true shooting percentage of that field. It's impressive to have a true shooting percentage below 50 when you're shooting that high of a clip from 3. So
it's hard to understand how that's even possible.
He's not shooting poor at the free throw line either. I think he's at 86% or around there right now, 86.1%. He doesn't take a ton of threes, just 2.7 attempts per 36 minutes. Yeah, that's, yeah. But it's still.
He's taking 11 twos. There you go.
Yeah, that's where he's killing himself. He's 41.8% on 2-pointers, only shoots 54.7% around the rim, 26.7% from floater range. But again, that this team doesn't turn the ball over more, given who their primary ball handlers are, actually impresses me. So I thought I'd go with sort of a happy stat there. It's just really tough to judge this team, and perhaps, spoiler alert, your grade is just better for that exact reason.
Yeah, they got an incomplete from me at the quarter mark, and they get an incomplete now. and I think my reasoning for it, the first incomplete was they hadn't traded Kevin Love yet, and they still haven't traded Kevin Love. So
but he's injured and not even playing. I don't even know how that's like part of your.
It may be hard for them to trade him this season if he doesn't play at all. I don't know how many teams are willing to take a swing on him when he's played in 4 games the entire season. So maybe at this point I should give him a real grade and dock them for not trading him this offseason. I think they should have made the deal, but I haven't heard anything really about his progress. So maybe there's no chance that he comes back between now and the deadline. But other than that, it's the Colin Sexton shot profile stuff is really interesting to me. If you had to peg 3 guys on this team, I know for the Hawks, I said it was Collins, Young, and Herter, and I felt pretty comfortable there. Can you pick 3 young players from this roster that you would confidently move forward with?
Oh, confidently.
Because I guess you kind of have to with Sexton, and it's too early to give up on him. Jetty Osman's only 23, so I think he's got to be in there. Larry Nance is already 26 years old. But I think that would probably
that would be the extent of their young players.
Yeah. Clarkson's 26, but I don't think you look at him as like a long-term.
Yeah, we're not calling Larry Nance a young player. We're not calling Colin Sexton. Are there any Cameron Payne believers still out there? I might be alone in that regard.
Yeah, I don't think I can join you on that one. How old is Cameron Payne?
24. He's 24.
So, yeah, maybe there's still a little bit of development left there.
Jaren Blossom game's even 25. Didn't realize he was that old.
It's crazy. They've got a bunch of guys who are young but not too young. So, like you said at the outset, it's a good thing that they're willing to play a little more ball in terms of, you know, taking back bad contracts in exchange for assets, because they don't really have a young core right now, and their primary goal at this point should be doing whatever they can to put that young core together.
Is there any competition for Sexton as their best prospect? And I'm more or less asking, how high are you on Jetty Osman at this point?
I would say there's competition between those two. Osman's 3 years older, but he's also bigger, and he's a little bit more positionless, which I think is more the future of the game than a Colin Sexton type. I don't know if it's just their offense. I probably haven't watched Cleveland enough this season. I've seen them a few times, but you would think a 6'2 point guard would average a little bit more than 2.8 assists per game. That 2.8 assist to 2.3 turnover ratio is not very flattering. I mean, there's a lot of things that Colin Sexton needs to work on, but he is 3 years younger than Osman, so he's got that going for him. But gosh, I actually don't know if I can make that call between those two. 3 years is a big gap, but Osman is bigger, and I think his game's a little bit more multifaceted right now.
Fair enough. That brings – so you copped out and gave them an incomplete, just to refresh. That brings us to the Detroit Pistons, who are 25th in offensive efficiency, 12th in defensive efficiency, 23rd in net rating, 20-26 at this recording. You gave them a C+ for the first quarter grades. I gave them a B, which I just don't even remember doing. They're down to a C- for me. I get that they're not deep, but they almost feel like identityless. It's Blake Griffin needs to play like a top 15 NBA player every night, and we're still probably going to lose. When you look at their defensive standing, I think it's natural to be like, oh, hey, you know, 12th in defensive efficiency, that's fine. I'm not convinced that that's going to last, which are where my key stats are for them. Opponents are shooting 34.2% against them on wide open three-pointers, which just has lucky written all over it. That's the third lowest mark on wide open three-pointers in the league. Only the Lakers and Celtics opponents are shooting worse on uncontested trays. And when you look at their when you just look at their defense around the rim, it is not good. Andre Drummond in a vacuum has been okay as a rim protector this year, but they are more than 5 points better per 100 possessions defensively without him on the floor. And Detroit overall gives up the worst field goal percentage at the rim of any team. There are just red flags all over the place, and they're another franchise that just kind of looks locked into with what they had. They feel like a more extreme case of the Hornets at this point, except that Andre Drummond, I don't know. Can you say Andre Drummond is better than Charlotte's second best player? I think you can still say he's better than Cody Zeller, but I'm out on him. I just don't know that I understand that the passing was always going to drop alongside Blake Griffin, but his turnover percentage has only, while having diminished usage, he's shooting a lower percentage from the floor, and his turnover percentage hasn't really dropped by all that much. I don't know that I've seen a more least impactful, super high volume rebounder And I don't know if it's the roster setup at this point, but this whole Detroit is better without Drummond on the floor defensively is a multi-year trend. It predates Blake Griffin, and they're short on upside, and they're even thinner on trade assets. I don't know what they're going to do when looking at the bigger picture and into the offseason. Stanley Johnson is going to be a restricted free agent, and he has made, I would argue, zero improvement this year. Might have even regressed. Luke Kennard, I like Luke Kennard. I don't know if the Pistons feel the same way, really. His playing time has been sort of all over the place since he returned from injury earlier in the year. The Reggie Jackson stuff is concerning. I don't know what this team does from here, and they might still make the playoffs in the East, but they're two games back in the loss column as we're recording this, and for them to get anything meaningful done at the trade deadline, they probably have to give up their first-round pick. And I'm not sure that that's something you want to do just so you can get the 7 or 8 spot in the East.
Yeah. I agree with all that. Did you see what Duncan Smith tweeted about the Pistons the other day?
I did not.
I think he's been a guest on the podcast for one of our season previews. But he said, the summary of 2019's Pistons fandom: the organization has their best player since Isaiah Thomas, and I mostly just feel bad that he has to play here.
Wow.
Yeah. somebody in the comments pointed out that Grant Hill played in Detroit, which was probably a good thing to point out. But Blake Griffin has been stellar this season, and it's like you said, it just sort of feels like they're locked into mediocrity right now. As you were talking about Drummond, I was just sort of looking at the stat profile for the Pistons, and he's shooting less than 50% from the field in an era where there are so many rim rolling centers who are shooting like around 60% or higher. He's at 49.8% this season. Over the last 5 seasons, he's at 52% from the field. He started his career in his first 2 seasons shooting over 60. And then I think for a while there, Stan Van Gundy was trying to turn him into a post player. But Van Gundy's not there anymore. At some point, somebody needs to try and turn this guy into a rim rolling center, like a lot of the, you know, really effective bigs are in the NBA right now. You can still average like mid-teens in points just getting offensive rebounds and alley-oop dunks. So whatever they're doing with him offensively just isn't working. I like you said, it's hard to really see a way out for this roster. I don't know if you want to trade Blake Griffin, but after that, like, how do you move any of these guys?
And I don't even know what you could. I would say Blake Griffin is movable. He's probably improved his trade value since coming to Detroit. I shouldn't even use the probably disqualifier there. But what are you recouping in that deal? Even if you did move him, you're not going to be able to start over just because everyone's still going to look at that contract, and they're not going to see it as a, maybe it's no longer this albatross, but including this season, he's still on the books for 4 years and $142.3 million.
It's crazy. I think the one you'd like to move would be Reggie Jackson, but I don't know who's taking that deal. Almost $20 million for, I honestly don't even know what he provides.
It would have to be for like Nicholas Batum or something like that, like moving him and John Lohr for Nicholas Batum.
Which would I actually think that would probably make Detroit better. Drummond's contract.
I don't know. Bruce Brown is probably better than Nicholas Batum at this point.
Yeah, you could have an argument there. I didn't realize that Drummond's going to make close to $30 million over each of the next 2 seasons too. His contract's huge. I mean, they're one of these teams that's just they've committed a ton of money to a top three that's probably not. It's just going to compete for like 7th or 8th in the East at best. So they're kind of stuck. I don't even know what. I didn't even say what I gave them. I gave them a C. I still think there's maybe a chance that they make the playoffs. in the East. Blake Griffin's been playing out of his mind. If he can get a little help from two or three other guys, maybe they figure that out some point down the road. But right now, it's just sort of a blah experience. I think Duncan Smith's tweet was pretty telling.
Yeah, I'm with you there. That would bring us to Indiana. They are 15th in offensive efficiency, 2nd in defensive efficiency, and 4th in net rating, 31-15 overall. You gave them an A for the first quarter grade. I gave them a B+. I have them up to an A- now. They found something within themselves when Victor Oladipo missed time with that knee injury early in the season. They're more offense by committee now, and it sort of just shows. Victor Oladipo's usage rate is down. This team has been confusing me, though, sort of since the turn of the calendar. It's like their identities haven't flip-flopped, but they've struggled defensively, which probably coincides with the time that Miles Turner missed. Since January 1st, though, they're 9th in offensive efficiency and 17th in defensive efficiency, which just feels like a complete identity reversal from where they were at the beginning of the season. And then you look at during this time, since January 1st, you have Victor Oladipo shooting under 33% from three. Bojan Bogdanovic is at 33.3% from three. So their two most talented scorers aren't really shooting the ball that well from the outside, and yet they're top 10 in offense since January 1st. I know Darren Collison has been shooting the ball really well. We know that Sabonis has been great this year. Thaddeus Young has just been filling all kinds of voids for them, really bridging that area between big and wing. It's still so good defensively. I really do like this team. They are so deep. Miles Turner has somehow become one of the most underrated players in the NBA. He should finish, I would think, in the top three for Defensive Player of the Year voting, top five at worst, if people are worried about him averaging under 30 minutes per game. I'm curious to see just how this develops and whether this trend holds where the offense has been outperforming their defense, because that has not been the identity of this team. Perhaps at the beginning of last season, but over the second half of last year and then for most of this year, it's been the other way around. And so I found those just calendar flippings splits a little interesting. The key stat I had, though, was just just a celebration of Miles Turner's rim protection. Opponents are shooting 54.6% against him at the rim, which is the 5th best mark in the league among everyone who is defending at least 5 shots at the rim per game. The only players in front of him are Joel Embiid, Hassan Whiteside, Serge Ibaka, and your guy, JaVale McGee.
Started with your guy, and I thought you were going to say Gobert, and I'm so happy it was JaVale. I gave him an A, and I think I gave him an A the first time. I think you said that, yeah. They are right in the thick of it in the Eastern Conference. They're how many games back are they of the – they're just like a 2.5 games behind the first-place Toronto Raptors. And to be in this position when you missed Victor Oladipo for double-digit games is really impressive to me. And not only did he miss a bunch of time, he's not – close to the player that he was last season. Maybe that's overstating it a little bit, but
his efficiency, his shot difficulty and the types of attempts he's taking really haven't changed, but his efficiency is down, and there's definitely more of an emphasis on him facilitating for the rest of the team.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. His field goal percentage is down about 5 points. 3-point percentage is down about 3 points, but like you said, he's averaging one more so anyway, for them to be in the thick of it with him missing a bunch of time and him not quite being the same player that he was last season is really just impressive to me. And they, like you said, they have this really strong balanced attack now. After him, between Bojan Bogdanovic, who's at 16, and Corey Joseph, who's at 7.2, and we could even go to McDermott at 6.7, they've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 or 8 guys contributing in a fairly meaningful way to the points that they're scoring. So they have a nice balanced offense. They have, like you said, one of the best defenders in the league in Miles Turner. I still don't think that Tyreek Evans has given them what he can. Like if they ever get the Tyreek Evans that played in Memphis last season, I think there's maybe another level to this team. And I think Oladipo can be better too. So this is a team that's just sort of cruising along with a chance to get even better. So I expected them to be a comfortable playoff team this season. I didn't really expect them to be in that mix for home court advantage, or this like solidly in that mix.
Yeah, I mean, they've been just fantastic overall. And if you're going to say that Tyreek Evans hasn't really shot the ball well all year, what you're getting from Victor Oladipo, just looking at his efficiency, he's still a good defender. And again, I think he really helps with just the space and the chaos that his dribble penetration creates for them. And just the threat of him really changes the way that defenses have to approach the Pacers. They've had a fantastic year. We did, however, we're only about halfway through the Eastern Conference, so rather than keep you guys here for another 6 hours, we are going to cut it off. I did want to ask you, though, really quick, Andy. The report came from Woj, I think it was yesterday. We're recording this on an early Wednesday morning, and it came on Tuesday, I believe, that the Grizzlies are open to entertaining offers for Marc Gasol or Mike Conley. Do you expect either of them to get moved by the trade deadline?
Which one of those two do you think has more trade value? It's Conley, right?
It's tough. I would say yes, because he's having a good season. But when you look at, you know, including this year, he's at 3 years and $97.5 million.
Yeah.
That's just a lot with his injury history. And is there a team out there that might see value in Gasol potentially declining his $25.6 million player option?
And that player option is for 19-20.
Yeah.
That does make it a little bit.
If you take contracts out of the equation, I think it's Mike Conley, and it's not even close at this point. Yeah.
I think I might go Conley either way, but it's got to be a team. It seems like just about the entire league has cap space this summer, but maybe there's some team out there that just doesn't. They think we're not going to land anybody anyway, so we might as well take a swing at it now. And maybe you just kind of talk yourself into Mike Conley being your free agent acquisition.
It's fitting that we closed on the Pacers just because they were the team that NBA Twitter was talking about as the perfect destination for Conley. The logistics of getting him there are really difficult because I don't know. They have the expiring money to make it work, but who do you actually want to trade from that Pacers roster? But
yeah, like well, we were just talking about them, and they're so solid, and I think their depth is a big part of what makes them good right now. But, you know, there are arguments for consolidating depth into star players. Does it possibly raise their ceiling in the playoffs a little bit if they've got Mike Conley starting instead of Darren Collison? I certainly think Mike Conley's a better player than Collison, but maybe Collison is just as good of a fit as Mike Conley would be.
I'd like to see him in Charlotte next to Kemba Walker.
You mentioned that earlier, and it's kind of hard to wrap my head around their deficiency in size.
Fair.
On the court at the same time, but it would certainly be interesting offensively to see those two guys out there together. That'd be really, really tough to defend. I need to think about this a little bit more and actually look at some teams that might go after him. I know that there's a lot of Jazz fans that are like all in on going to get Mike Conley. But the stuff you mentioned is worrisome to me. The long contract, the injury history, it's not a no-brainer to me for whichever team acquires him, because if you get a guy that you're going to have to pay $30 million a year for the next, what is it, 4 years, or is it 3 years after this one? And he only gives you, I don't know, 40 games per season. That's
well, that's a gross underestimate. I mean, that's the extreme end of the spectrum. No, yeah,
that's worst case scenario.
Right.
if you get him and he gives you 60 to 65 games a season, I mean, he's still missing big chunks of each year, but that's probably still decent value for certain teams.
Does it maybe is the way I phrased it screwing you up? So Conley's deal has 2 years after this one. So it's exactly 2 years and $67 million. I was just including this season in the total commitment. Does that make you feel any better when it's spun in that context?
Maybe a little bit. I guess back to your original question, I think if I had to pick one that's more likely to be traded this season, I'm probably going to go with Conley.
Really?
Yeah. Neither one is a spring chicken, but Marc Gasol is 34. And he's been all over the place offensively for two seasons. I think he still brings some value as a defender. And for the first like 2 or 3 weeks of this season, he was number one in real plus minus, which was, kind of shocking, and advanced numbers still are fairly high on him. But I just feel like there's probably more teams that can talk themselves into a guy who's still sort of in the back end of his prime and averaging 20 points a game, in a league that I think still really, really loves playmakers and guards. So if I had to go with one, I'm probably going Conley. It sounds like you're going to go with Gasol.
Right. And if I had to pick the player that was going to get them a bigger return in a trade, I would pick Conley. But the Grizzlies, just based off everything we've seen, it sort of feels like they would rather trade Gasol. Maybe they feel like they're going to lose him and they recoup anything for his departure. And then they're just going to try and do it all over again next season and get back to the playoffs with Conley and Jaren Jackson Jr. And then maybe their first round pick, assuming that in that scenario, it wouldn't convey to the Celtics. That seems like the more likely scenario to me. And with Gasol's free agency coming up again, I think the fact that he could be a flight risk, since Mark Stein of the New York Times reported last week that there's the increasing belief around the league that Gasol is going to decline that player option, I think there'd be extra motivation there to move Gasol. They should probably move both and really just try and start over. But I don't know if the Grizzlies have the stomach or think that they have the stomach for a full tilt rebuild. I would still think Gasol's the most likely one to get moved, and that Conley's the more valuable player at this point.
I can see that, and there has been at least some friction between Gasol and the organization over the last couple of years, so maybe that's a factor as well. But I think what they should do is move both. You just mentioned that, but I just don't know if they'll. You know, there's a lot of small market teams who understandably are hesitant to go into a full blown teardown and rebuild. But I think that's probably where they're at.
The last thing I want to ask you is, Shams reported Tuesday night that Anthony Davis will see a hand specialist in fear that his hand injury might be a little bit more serious. Called it a volar plate avulsion fracture in his left index finger, potentially, which would force Anthony Davis to miss 2 to 4 weeks. If Anthony Davis is missing the next month of basketball, the Pelicans can't afford to go a week or two, let alone four.
Yeah.
What do they do? What do they do? They're in and out. You can't tank. Even right before you're supposed to give Davis a designated veteran extension, you're going to shut him down for the rest of the year, trade Julius Randle, maybe you keep Mirotic because you're going to have his bird rights, and then hope that you're able to lose more than the Mavericks, Pistons, Wizards, Magic, Grizzlies, Hawks, Bulls, Suns, Knicks, Cavaliers. They're in this impossible situation.
Yeah, I don't know what you do either. They're 22 and 25 right now. They are currently eighth in the West based on percent chance of getting into the playoffs from 538. And if he misses 3 or 4 weeks, like you're saying, that percentage is just going to fall off a cliff over the next couple of seasons. Although they just crushed the Grizzlies without Davis, and that's the Grizzlies. They're going to have tougher opponents than that while Anthony Davis is out. And any kind of slippage in the West right now can be just devastating.
Yeah.
For your playoff hopes. The Clippers have fallen off a bit, but they're still in the mix. The Timberwolves are just kind of hanging around. The Kings are just kind of hanging around. The Lakers are going to get LeBron back pretty soon. This is if you want to make the playoffs, this is not a good time or a good conference to be in to not have your best player for a month. So
fair assessment.
This is a precarious moment for the New Orleans Pelicans, for sure.
I'm with you.
I think that wraps us up. Like Dan said, we only got about halfway through the Eastern Conference. We were joking about having to talk about the East, and then we were going much longer on some of these teams than we did on the West. So
it was all your Jabari Parker optimism that derailed us.
Yeah. We're going to be back with more Eastern Conference optimism later this week. We'll finish up the Eastern Conference, so you'll have everyone's grades. I know you're dying to have the complete report card before the end of this week, so we will provide that for you. But until then, if you want to talk to us about the teams that we've already discussed, you can find Dan on Twitter at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show is at Hardwood Knox. The sponsor is at NBA underscore math. As Dan said, we sincerely appreciate all the ratings and the reviews and the subscriptions that we already have, but we're greedy and we're needy, and we want more of both of those things. So if you've already done those three things, encourage your friends to hop on board and listen to some Hardwood Knox and talk about our hot takes on your lunch breaks with them. And until next time, we'll leave you with a shout out to Ben Oudry and Kyle Anderson.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Jay Farner, CEO of Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. We've created a new way to protect you from unpredictable interest rates. Our exclusive Rate Shield approval. First, we lock your interest rate for up to 90 days. Then, if rates go up, your rate stays locked. But if rates go down, your rate drops. Either way, you win. Call us today at 800-QUICKEN or go to rocketmortgage.com.
Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year fixed rate loans. Call for cost information and conditions. Equal housing lender. License in all 50 states. NMLS number 3030. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply.